This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
When you're sat in a room surrounded by photographs of newborn babies to be told your baby's passed away, when you're told that, don't worry, you know you can get pregnant, don't worry, at least you know you can have another one, you know, all surreal things that I despair at when I hear now. People don't want to hear that rubbish. You know, they've just lost a child. They want to know that that child was the most important thing in everybody's world, and it's important for everyone to understand that.
Welcome to A Journey with Abigail's Footsteps, a podcast about the difference this baby loss charity is making to lives across the country. I'm Nicola Everett, a very proud ambassador of Abigail's Footsteps, a charity that supports families at the most difficult time and provides training to healthcare professionals. Sadly, in the UK, it's estimated that one in four pregnancies ends in the loss of a baby. Despite that figure, it's still something that many find difficult to talk about, and families can face a wall of silence. We're hoping this series of podcasts will break down that wall. Parents will be sharing their own experiences, which at times may be difficult to listen to. But we will also hear their inspirational stories of resilience and hope, and how you can get involved in making a difference to so many amazing families. Thank you for listening to episode one, where I'm joined by David Ward, the co-founder of Abigail's Footsteps. David and his wife Jo set up the charity in 2010, a year after their daughter Abigail was stillborn. David, thank you so much for being on the podcast. We're really delighted to have you on this episode. I want to go back, if we can, to early 2009. You were expecting your baby, Abigail. What was the start of that year like, the months leading up to when Abigail was due?
Lots of excitement. The sun was shining. We were enjoying a really good summer. And, you know, all was good. The nursery had been decorated. We'd been buying things. The cot was made. All was in good order. It was exactly as we'd hoped it would be. And due date arrived, and actually we went past the due date.
And as far as you and your wife were concerned, there was nothing wrong, nothing to worry about at all with your baby?
No, nothing at all. You know, Jo was a new mum, so it was all very new to her, but did all the things that, you know, a new mum would do. She didn't drink. She'd never smoked anyway, ate really well. Occasionally was a little bit concerned, but, you know, was reassured that all was in good order. Again, everything was well. And I think even at the end that, you know, we thought everything was okay. We didn't really think there was any problem. There was nothing to really cause any alarm or concern.
You said Jo went past her due date. So what happened then? Did you decide to get in touch with the hospital and say, look, what's going on? What do we need to be doing?
It's amazing, isn't it? Having gone through the journey we've gone through, we know so much more now than we did back then. And of course, if we knew then what we know now, we would have been having phone calls and making more conversation with people. We were just expecting to, you know, we were advised that going over the due date was normal. There was nothing to worry about. There was no third scan in those days, so there was nothing to really look at. Jo was a little concerned one Sunday about movements, and we went up to the hospital, but they advised us that everything was okay. And just to be patient, the date would come and all would be well. And of course, it didn't happen that way. The movements stopped again. And on a Sunday early evening, we went up to the hospital for scans and heart movement measurement. And they couldn't find a heartbeat. They weren't sure what had happened, but they couldn't find a heartbeat. And rather than confirm anything there and then, they wanted us to return on the Monday morning for a scan, which would then outline what had happened. So, of course, we went back home. Actually, we went back to Jo's parents for the evening. Obviously, didn't sleep, didn't have a clue what was really going on. I feared the worst, but weren't quite sure. And then returned on the Monday morning to be told that the scan had indicated that the baby was no longer viable. Abigail had passed away, her heartbeat had stopped, and she was no more. And it was a bit surreal, really. You thought you were in a soap opera. You thought you were watching something that someone else was going through. You didn't really believe it was in your own world it was happening. The night before, we were pretty sure we knew what was happening. You know, there was no heartbeat, but to have it confirmed on the Monday morning was heartbreaking. And I always remember walking into the hospital with Jo We had a suitcase for her belongings, obviously, to stay in hospital. And a lady was coming out of the maternity suite. If I remember correctly, I think she was a cleaner. And she could see Joe heavily pregnant, me pulling the suitcase, Joe in tears, and kindly reassured us that everything would be okay. We had nothing to worry about. And I felt for her afterwards because she had no idea what we were going through. Apparently, she was devastated later to find out who we were. And I just thought it's just, you know, the natural instinct of assuming everything's okay and everyone's going to be all right. And of course, walking into that corridor that day, it wasn't.
Joe gave birth to baby Abigail. What was the time like after that? Because you were trying to process this awful, awful thing that had happened. And then she gave birth to your beautiful baby girl.
Yeah, she did. I mean, we arrived in the hospital on the Monday morning. We stayed for 2 nights in what is now the Bluebell room. And on day three, Abigail was born on the Wednesday. And again, all very surreal. Jo wanted to deliver naturally, so she did. And we had a little bit of time with Abigail, not a lot, because there was no such thing as an Abby Colcott then or the facility to look after her. So we literally had probably two and a half hours with her. And in that time, managed to get some of the family members up to see her. We couldn't touch her. We couldn't hold her. She was very, very fragile. We managed to get the chaplain to do a very brief service of blessing for her. He couldn't baptise her because she wasn't alive, but he could give her a blessing, which is what we wanted. Although we're not deeply religious, we just felt it was only right. And literally that was it. She was taken away to the mortuary and we were never to see her again. And this is what I don't think people understand. You know, Jo carried her for nine months, 42 weeks gestation she carried her for. And she meets her for a very brief moment in time. And people think you're going to get over that. And you don't get over that. You know, even today, even with two other children, I know Jo's heart is broken. And she really struggles with it, you know. We both do. It's, you know, the room's ready, the cot's ready, the car seat's ready. She's going to come home. And of course, she doesn't. And people think you're going to just go over it and move on, and you don't.
When we first met, David, I remember that some of the most powerful things you telling me was what other people had said to you when you were in that maternity suite. Does that still play on your mind now? Are you happy to share some of those conversations?
Yeah, it does. I mean, the film, The Deafening Silence, was very much our journey. And, you know, the team that made the film did an amazing job. They really took on the whole story. And I think, you know, when you're sat in a room surrounded by photographs of newborn babies to be told your baby's passed away, when you're told that, don't worry, you know, you can get pregnant, don't worry, at least you know you can have another one, you know, all surreal things that I despair at when I hear now. And a lot of the work we've done in the, you know, since that day was to ensure that we help midwives and care staff with the, you know, what to say. People struggle with what to say around death anyway. And in difficult situations, we always seem to make a hash of it. We always seem to trip up ourselves up. So we're very keen to try and help express, you know, what you should and shouldn't say. And time isn't a healer. People don't want to hear that rubbish. You know, they've just lost a child. They want to know that that child was the most important thing in everybody's world. And it's important for everyone to understand that. You know, we always use Abigail's name. The children, you know, we've had subsequently, Reuben and Betty. We always use Abigail's name. We always talk about her. We have photographs of her. We have a single photograph of her in her cot. You know, we talk about her a lot. Not to the detriment of the other children, but just to understand that, you know, life was as life was, and life, you know, progresses on. Of course it does. But those conversations with people, and I mean, early days, some people were very supportive and very caring, but other people, they wouldn't phone, they wouldn't call, they'd cross the road because they didn't know what to say and they found it very awkward. And that was very uncomfortable for everybody. Something that we struggled with for a while.
You were obviously in 2009 dealing with a huge amount of grief and trying to come to terms with what had happened. When did you make the decision that your experience had to help other people?
I think we wanted to do something for Abigail after we'd lost her. And I think the original plan was to do some fundraising for SANS, which we did in 2010. We held a charity ball at Gillingham Football Club and had a great dinner there. People attended. We raised some money. We donated it to SANS. And didn't really hear any more about where the money went or what it did, to be honest. And then we stopped to think about our own journey and the fact that we couldn't spend any time with Abigail. The midwives hadn't really received any proper bereavement training. The facilities in the hospital were poor. I mean, we were in a room that was on the main corridor of the delivery area. So every time the door opened, we could hear parents talking or hear newborn babies crying. It was all just completely wrong. And I think having had time to process that, we decided that we were going to start to do things differently and start to make challenges. The first thing we did was actually buy a cold cot from another company. And I was absolutely shocked at the cost. They were, I don't know, £4,000 or £5,000 at the time. It was made okay. It wasn't brilliant. It was an okay standard. But it meant the hospital could actually, you know, use it for bereaved parents to spend time with baby. And, you know, that cot is such an important piece of kit because with the right support from the bereavement team, mum and dad can have baby for 2, 3, 4 days even if they want to. And, you know, spend time with them to get to create memories they wouldn't have had otherwise. And I think that was probably the big thing for us. And ironically, the hospital, we just replaced it, I think, last year. It was 10 years old. So, you know, they've now got two cots in Midway. But obviously, the Abigail's Place was a big thing for us. We spent a long time working with the hospital management team. I remember the first day they thought I was going to rock up with a cheque for £150,000 and they were going to build a bereavement suite. And I walked into a meeting room with about 15 people in it and I said, I've got no money, but I want a bereavement suite, which didn't go down very well. Very, very lucky at the time, a lady called Lynn Sheridan, who's now just become a trustee of Abigail's, fantastically, got what we were trying to do, understood the challenges we were facing and worked so hard and tirelessly to make it happen for us. And then, of course, Cheryl Baker, bless her, who's been a fantastic vice patron and supporter from the outset, started doing TV shows to raise money for us. And, you know, I remember the phone call. I'm really sorry, I didn't quite get what I wanted. I only got £25,000. And it's like, hang on a minute, you've just raised £25,000. It was unbelievable. So the requirement for £150,000 with a cheque turned into a bartering match with the hospital over the space we wanted. We took restrooms that were for doctors on shift, and they had three. We wanted three. They wanted to donate one. Then we got two. Then we got 2.5. And we finally got the third one. You know, and the hammer going through the wall that first day was superb. And, you know, working with a lot of local people and a lot of supporters to raise the additional funds. And the suite's I'm so proud of, because even now it looks immaculate. It's very well cared for. Sadly, many people have used it. And of course, we'd love to have had it that no one ever used it, but many people have used it. It's beautifully furnished. Peter Harrison, who owns Furniture Village, I remember going to see him and asking if he'd help support us and maybe give us some discount on the furniture. And he said, I can't do that, David. I can't give any discount on the furniture. I went, oh, okay. He said, no, because we're going to donate everything from the furnishings to the mirrors, the pictures. They even went and paid for a special bed for the room. That sort of thing really, you know, really brought out the best in people. And it was so, so heartwarming to see that. So the suite's beautiful. It's, as I say, been used many times. There is a book kept in there for parents to write notes in. I've never read it. I can't read it. I don't want to read it because it's too personal for me for our own story. But the fact that we've managed to have other parents use that room with the cots and have that time with their baby has been so important.
At the start of the charity being set up, you were already incredibly busy. You had a company. The charity has grown and grown and got busier and busier. Did you ever imagine that it would become what it has become and that it supported just so many people?
No, I mean, it was interesting early on. Someone said to me that many parents did what we did. They'd start a charity in their child's name. They'd run it for a year or two, then they'd be happy and satisfied and they'd step away. I don't think Joe and I'll ever be happy or satisfied. You know, obviously we'd love it that it was never needed. But as the team have demonstrated, I mean, you know, we were lucky to get Faye Hill join us 3, 4 years ago, who's been phenomenal. She's really helped take the charity on to the next level. It got to a point where I just couldn't do it. I was working till 2 a.m. on the charity, then doing the day work, and it just was very difficult. Faye came in with a great wave of enthusiasm and energy and has built a team around her and continue to grow the charity. And I'm just blown away with what they're achieving. This small Kent charity is now, you know, looking after a lot of people in the southeast of England and London, providing many different services. The cots have gone national. We could claim internationally because they're in Scotland and Wales. So, you know, and it continues. And I mean, we're now looking at doing some more work with the counselling for parents. We're looking at doing some more work for the counselling support for professional staff. We're not done. We're just on, you know, the beginning of the journey, I feel, still.
You mentioned earlier how important it is for you as a family to keep Abigail's memory very much alive and to say her name. How much do you like hearing other people say her name when they talk about the charity and they talk about the fundraising that they're doing, and you've got the Abigail's Bereavement Suite, you've got the Abigail's Cots. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, it's fantastic. In some ways, it's quite funny, isn't it? Because she'll outlive all of us. Her legacy will go on long well after we've all gone. And obviously, it was tragic what happened, and it devastated both of us. But to see the positive work that's come out of her memory and her legacy is means a lot.
I want to talk about the films. You mentioned earlier the films that you've produced. Can you tell us a bit about why you decided to produce those films and share the story in that way as well?
Yeah, so the journey needed to be told, the story needed to be told. And another one of our vice patrons is Juliet Chingham, who is the ITV newscaster. And her husband, Nick Gardner, had a film company called White Boat TV. And we were looking to get a film made, and we had an idea that it'd be about £5,000 to £6,000. And Nick said, look, I'm really sorry, but the budget isn't going to cut it. It's going to need to be a lot more than that. But then he explained what the project would look like and how it would be produced and how it would be dealt with. And it was a no-brainer. We had to go with Nick. So, of course, we fundraised again. Cheryl again did probably more TV shows, bless her, and raised more money. Everyone else raised money. The Deafening Silence was filmed in Medway Hospital. A lot of people supported us. One of the biggest supporters at the time was Kate Harris, who's now also recently become a trustee, who'd only recently encountered her own stillbirth and was obviously still very raw with her own loss, but so generously and so kindly gave her time to ensure the film was right. We didn't want it to be challenged at a later date for being unprofessional or insensitive or whatever. And Kate put a lot of time and effort into that, which was really, really appreciated. So it was filmed in Medway. We had two amazing actors, played the husband and wife. It was filmed over a long weekend. And I was privileged enough to see one day of the filming and was just blown away by the people that played the parts. Then we see the first cuts. We see the first part of the story, and it blew us away. It was everything that we wanted it to be and more. You know, the walking up the corridor, the inappropriate comments, all of that. The film captured everything. And the original thought was we'd launch it in Kent. It goes to Kent hospitals for Kent midwives and care staff to see and use as a training aid. We put it onto YouTube and off it went. And I think at the last count, it's had nearly 600,000 views. It's been viewed in over 100 countries. We've had requests from all over the world to use it for training. Unbelievable. As an aside, the film won 2 IVCA Gold Awards, which is like the industry BAFTAs. And then probably the biggest moment for us was it was entered into an international film festival, and we were sitting in about 15th place. It was an international competition voted for internationally by people. We were sitting in about 15th place, and we'd had a link into Amanda Holden and messaged Amanda and said, can you just give us a bit of a push on here? We want to try and promote this. So Amanda tweeted out and posted out what we were doing. She got us into the top 10. The top 10 were then put in front of the judges to be judge for the top places. And Abigail's and the Deafening Silence came second internationally to a film produced by Al Gore on world climate, which really did bring home to me the impact the film had made. It continues to be used around the world. It continues to be used around the UK for training. Again, it's probably 10 years old. So last year we launched Say My Baby's Name, which was the sequel. In the journey, it wasn't the same couple. It was a different couple because we wanted to just show the diversity that, you know, this doesn't matter who you are, this impacts on everybody. And we had a new couple come in, and the film demonstrated the issue about not saying baby's name and how unkind and hurtful it felt for the mother particularly, but the rest of the family. And it really brought home again that whole thing about don't be afraid. If someone doesn't want you to say the name, they'll say, please don't say their name. But 99 times out of 100, they'll want baby spoken about. They'll want their name used. They don't want to lose that personal touch. And again, a very, very powerful film. So it could be used again as a training aid and to further help development and training of midwives and care people around the country.
Baby loss charity Abigail's Footsteps offers counselling for grieving parents and specialist bereavement training for midwives and healthcare professionals. With compassion and care, Abigail's Footsteps has provided solace to countless bereaved families across Kent and the UK. Their Abbey cooling cots have allowed hundreds of parents to cherish precious moments and make memories with their baby, additional time they thought they might never have. Your generous support, help and donations will make all the difference in enabling this incredible Kent charity to continue their invaluable services. To learn how you can make a meaningful difference and support Abigail's Footsteps, visit their website at abigailsfootsteps.co.uk.
David, if we could just go back, because you mentioned that you and Joe have gone on to have two other children, and you said about how important it was to speak about Abigail. What do they think about the charity, and do they talk about their older sister?
Yeah, they do. So Reuben and Betty are 13 and 11, nearly 12, or going on 22, I think Betty is actually, but anyway. And they've been heavily involved from the outset, really. You know, from when they were able to walk and talk, they've always been to events with us. At the last gala dinner, Reuben and Betty were on the stage helping the auctioneer and helping with raffle tickets. They get what it's about, they understand what we're doing, and they realise how important it is to us. And without it being at their expense or compromising them at all, we've been to the cathedral with them, we've been to the castle and done balloon releases with them. We've done all sorts, and you know, they get it, they understand, and you know, we celebrate her birthday every year, April the 29th. It's just really nice. It's just, you know, she is part of the family and not forgotten.
You've spoken about the bereavement suites and the cold cots, and you've also mentioned about supporting midwives and the teams who look after mums and dads. How important was it to you that they received training? Because presumably you were quite surprised that midwives weren't getting training to deal with a bereavement following a birth.
That's right, and it's still happening now. Many of the colleges and universities that provide training don't cover bereavement. I remember a few years ago, a very good friend, she trained to become a midwife, and I saw a post on Facebook one morning how she'd sat in her car crying her eyes out, and it dawned on me she'd just dealt with a death in the hospital. And yet again, another person who hadn't had any training or anything, any support on how to deal with it. So we're very keen to ensure that we help with the training side of things, but also we help with the pastoral care of the professional people as well. So the training, yeah, very much, you know, what to expect, how to deal with it, how to have those difficult conversations, and to talk openly with other colleagues to understand those that have experienced it, how to deal with it, and how to react. But also, I think their own welfare as well. I can't imagine anything more traumatic than trying to help deliver a baby in one room and then looking after a mother with a stillborn baby in another room. You know, the emotional drain and challenge here, how on earth does anybody cope with that? And we're very keen to try and help promote that. And we've launched a new scheme to help midwives and others receive pastoral care and support from our counselling team to enable them to get the support they need as well. Because I don't think, again, there's anything in the NHS structure at this current time to support anybody from a professional point of view, which is, again, unacceptable.
We mentioned about the fundraising and how vital that has been to provide so much equipment. Does it still blow your mind how generous people are? Because you've raised a phenomenal amount of money, haven't you? And been involved in an awful lot of businesses as well across the county.
Yeah, we have. I mean, we've been absolutely blown away. And do you know, it's parents from all walks of life who get involved and bring others in. One that springs to mind is a local lady, Molly Hope, who decided she was going to fundraise. And honestly, I don't believe there was anybody in the Midway Towns who didn't donate, because Molly was such an enthusiastic fundraiser, and her family and her friends and colleagues all got involved, and she raised a phenomenal sum. I can't recall the figure now, but it was one of the largest amounts raised individually by somebody. And then she went and did it again. And, you know, Molly's now one of our ambassadors, as are many of the other families that get involved. And it's the other thing as well for me, is they don't just raise on one occasion and then call it a day. Lots of them continue to fundraise and support, even though their own loss may have been, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago. They still continue to support and fundraise. And I think the fact that we are starting to spread across the country, we are starting to help hospitals across the whole of the UK, allows people further afield to get involved as well. My daughter April recently moved up to Newcastle, and I saw photographs and video this week of Abigail Bear with the Angel of the North and around the hot spots of Newcastle. And I believe she's even having a meet-up with the Newcastle Football Club mascot. So Abigail's is now in Newcastle, but we are supporting hospitals up there. We will support staff with training up there. So, you know, the journey continues.
You will be helping even more people, unfortunately. We know that this is something that is going to happen to other parents in future. Let's talk a bit about the businesses that support you as well, because they've been really vital in helping you provide a lot of this equipment, haven't they?
They have indeed. I mean, the company that springs to mind straight away is the Bond Group, based over in Sheppey. Having seen that first cot we purchased for Medway, I was very disappointed with the quality and the price. I spoke to a local accountant and said, do you know anybody in Kent who deals with refrigeration? He sent me over to the Bond Group and I sat down there with a gentleman and said, I would like you to build these for me. Can you help? And he went, yeah, of course we can. And he called in a guy called Phil Proudman, and Phil Proudman was given the task of helping us, and Phil did. They built the first cots. They reduced the price significantly. The quality was far better, and they've continued on that journey with us to evolve and develop them and to improve the fit out of them. I asked Phil why they were so keen to help us, and he said, A, we want to help you because you're a local charity, but B, many of our own team have been through similar circumstances, and Paul in the finance team has also sadly been through this same thing as well. And Paul has been another amazing supporter, and the Bond Group has just been amazing. I mean, they continue to strive forward. They continue to try and improve the design. They continue to try and keep the cost as low as they possibly can. We don't make profit out of the cots at all. There's never been our ambition to make profit. So it's the cost of the cot and the transport costs. And, you know, that is how the fundraisers are raising the money they are, because they can raise the right amount of money for the right cot and get it out. And the Bond Group have been superb, been absolutely superb. But many other local companies have supported us. You know, every time there's an event going on, there's a golf day or there's some other event, we have numbers of people getting involved. I think the golf day this year sold out within days, and I believe they actually sold out for next year by the close of the game this year. So local companies want to get involved. We try and give value for money. We try and give a good day out. We try and ensure that people have fun, but they also understand what we're doing. And, you know, we're fundraising all the time. I mean, this year, I mean, Becky Hopkins, our fundraising manager, somehow got hold of a Haaland shirt from Manchester City. I have no idea how she managed to get hold of it. I never ask. But got hold of a signed Haaland shirt, and it raised a considerable sum at the golf day. And it's those sorts of things. It's the donations of the prizes. It's the people that willingly buy them. And we're so, so grateful for all of the support we get. And yeah, there are always, you know, surprises. There's always someone saying, oh, by the way, I've just dropped this in the post for you. You know, someone else is a trustee of a charity fund where the original founder of the charity passed away 3-4 years ago. They are still managing the fund. Abigail's every year get a very generous donation towards the work we're doing, because they recognise that we are doing important work and it goes directly to the parents' care and the staff's care.
We've already mentioned Abigail's really now, although very much started here in Kent, has spread across the country and to other countries as well. What are your thoughts about where the charity goes in the future? What are you anticipating, or what do you hope it will do in future?
I mean, obviously the hope is always that the charity is no longer needed and we can close it down. Sadly, that's not going to be the case. I think the thing for me is we have still got hospitals where the infrastructure is poor. How can it be acceptable for a mother who's just lost her baby to be put into a four-bedded ward with three mothers who've just delivered? How can it be acceptable for a bereavement suite to be down the end of a delivery area? It might suit the hospital management, it might suit the space allocation people, but put yourself in that place for a moment and think how you would feel if that was your family, that was your daughter or even your granddaughter that's just delivered a baby and they're having to be in those facilities. It's totally unacceptable. Staff should be receiving training properly. Cots should be everywhere where we need them. You know, we're not asking for much here. We're just asking for the basics. I'd love to see bereavement midwives with a recognised band and qualification. I'd like to see proper training and criteria, not just let's tick the box and calling over the nearest maternity midwife to make her the new bereavement midwife because it suits the latest CQC report inquiry or whatever it is they're going through at the time. I think we are in the world we're in. People are still going to lose babies no matter how much great work is done. And I think about my very good friend Ranjit Akolkar, professor at Medway, who has worked tirelessly for many years to make improvements. And people like him need to be listened to more because he does know what he's talking about. He does make a massive difference to the care of people. You know, let's talk about mums having a third scan in that late part of their pregnancy. I know many people that are now receive a scan in their 36th, 37th, 38th week. Problems are identified and the baby is delivered. We're not leaving babies to carry on and then to incur problems and pass away. So there's lots of work to be done still. I think there are some great people doing some great work. I think some people maybe coming at this from the wrong area. You think about counselling as an example. I could sit here and counsel you all day long about how I feel, but I'm not a professionally trained counsellor. And to give a bereaved parent counselling advice from someone that's not properly trained is just unacceptable. When we have Naomi Marston, who is, you know, a leading counsellor in this country, she is fully qualified and highly qualified. and she's created a great team around her. Bereaved parents need to be treated very carefully and with compassion and care, and to put them in the hands of somebody who isn't trained properly to give them compassionate, you know, support isn't acceptable. And these are the things I want to see changed. I want proper standards, I want proper regulation so people can receive the right care and the right support.
Do you look back sometimes and think how strange it is in a way that one life event that happened to you has changed your life completely? Because before Jo was pregnant with Abigail, I'm putting words in your mouth maybe, but I doubt you'd ever thought about setting up a charity maybe or supporting bereaved families. I mean, it's one absolutely tragic event that a lot of people would have grieved privately. Does it surprise you how you dealt with that situation and what you've done subsequently?
It's a really good question. And yeah, you're right. I mean, I'd never thought about setting up a charity. I would have got involved with other charities. Maybe I would have helped somewhere else. I sit as a trustee on two other charities now, but not to the same extent with Abigail's. I think I didn't want to lose the memory of Abigail. We never would have done, but I wanted her legacy to mean something. I wanted her being to be something. And the charity exceeded any expectations we ever thought of. And, you know, immensely proud of the work that's been done. Jo and I grieve in different ways. The charity was my way of having that release, having that way of grieving. Jo's been a phenomenal support and has often got involved in things. Sometimes when she really doesn't want to get involved, but she realises how important it is for me to deal with these things in my way. She has given so much to the family through Abigail and through the children. And I think, as I say, we both deal with it in different ways, but she's immensely proud of what's happened with the charity. She's immensely proud to see all that we continue to do and gets involved as much as she can still. But obviously, being a busy mum with two children, we're delighted of what we've achieved. Obviously, as I said from the outset, would love it to have never been needed at all. We'll continue to push the charity forward. We'll continue to raise money. We'll continue to raise awareness and train and develop people, hopefully, to give better service and better care to people.
Well, David, I know that the work that you, Jo, and all of the charity have done has been just fantastic for so many people. As you say, you'd rather you didn't have to do this at all. But sadly, a lot more families will need the support of Abigail's and its facilities in future. So on behalf of all of those people you've helped, if I could just say thank you, because I know from hearing from those people how much it's meant to them, and the work that you will continue to do is going to be such a huge support. And thank you ever so much for being on the podcast.
And I'll respond to that and thanking you for all of your support and kindness as well. And obviously, we're delighted that you're an ambassador of the charity as well, Nicola. And, you know, we joked just now about the runs you've been doing. I mean, I can't even run a bath nowadays, Nicola. The fact that you're doing a London Landmarks, is that the second or third one? I can't remember
how many.
Third one. I mean,
don't know how you've done it.
you deserve a medal. You absolutely deserve a medal. But it's, you know, people like yourself who've kindly got involved and kindly supported us with no thought of your own reward or anything. And that just means so much to all of us. So thank you to you and everyone else as well.
Thank you again to my guest, David Ward. And on the next episode, we'll be hearing how Abigail's Footsteps has supported mums following the loss of a baby. Thanks for listening to A Journey with Abigail's Footsteps. If you'd like more information about Abigail's Footsteps or how you can make a difference by supporting or donating, please click abigailsfootsteps.co.uk or follow us on social media.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.